they did. You don't know what they sacrificed. We have lost touch with the principles in the Constitution. Nobody's read the Declaration of Independence. You are voting for socialism, and you got what you voted for.
Welcome, bold Americans, to another episode of America Emboldened. As always, I'm your host, Greg Bolden, both here on the America Out Loud News Network, as well as all your social media channels. If you're joining us right now on X, Twitch, YouTube, you can put your comments in live while we're having our conversation with our guests tonight. We always love to hear from you. And if you're listening on the America Out Loud News Network, make sure you go to AmericaOutLoud.news. Check out all my colleagues' work. People like my great co-host, Chris Michaels. They can be heard every Monday at 7 p.m. with Unleashed the Political Hour. Chris Michaels, how are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. Pretty good. And you know what? It's almost time for celebration. So I am already getting mentally prepared for that.
1 week, brother. One week. 1 week till you tie the knot.
I know.
And you become a married individual like the rest of us. And hopefully you stay that way for many years, because not all of us do. But hey.
I know.
But I wish you the best. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Your fiance is going to hear this and be like, oh, that nut, Greg.
Yeah, right. But what's good? Listen, we've had a crazy, crazy week of all kinds of nonsense when it comes to January 6th and Fannie Willis basically being shut down, thankfully being shut down for at least 6 months. They knocked off six counts for 6 months?
That's correct.
They're going to review it in 6 months?
In those 6 counts, they did say that they could bring those counts back up with new, stronger evidence in order to reintroduce them. It was not a tossing of all six counts.
Yeah, so in other words, they had nothing.
Perhaps.
Right. So
I mean, I'm also seeing like there's some collusion now that we're hearing where could be that Trump's other court cases, looks like Smith might have talked to Willis and some collusion.
When you're visiting the White House and charging the White House for the visits, you know, like Nathan Wade, we have a problem. So that's where I think we should look into tonight. I think we should look into what's going on with these law cases and all this nonsense being thrown against Trump and other people that support Trump.
Well, the good news for our listeners and viewers is we have just the right person for the job tonight.
How serendipitous. Because
we're not lawyers, but this individual is actually one of the top lawyers in the country. He graduated from Harvard. He was the editor of Harvard Law Review, but he has some high-profile court cases behind him. Since January of 2016, he has served on the teams of people like Dr. Carter Page, Mayor Rudy Giuliani, George Papadopoulos, Tulsi Gabbard, and Kyle Rittenhouse, as well as, I believe it's over now, 20 defendants in connection to January 6th and what the Democrats would like to call that I word, which you and I don't believe that's what it was. But it'll be interesting to get our guest opinion of it. And tonight we have attorney John M. Pierce joining us. John, welcome to America Emboldened.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Glad to have you here. Thank you for, number one, fighting for the civil rights as well as our constitutional rights. Now, one of the things I want to point off right at the get-go, you're also the founder and chairman of the NCLU, which is the National Constitutional Law Union. We just had Gavin Wax on a couple weeks ago. He was talking about this, or maybe it was last week. They all run together to me. But he was talking about this. But when I was going on to the website, you guys, not just January 6th, you're talking about cancel culture. You're talking about the right to life. Personally, health freedom, after here we are almost 4 years to the anniversary where people lost their health freedom, where there was a part of this country that were trampling on people's religious liberty and religious rights, saying you had to go get vaccinated, you didn't get a choice behind the whole thing. And so the NCLU has been at the forefront of what you started, of representing people's constitutional rights. Tell me a little bit why you felt necessary to become the founder of this. What led you on that?
Yeah, so, you know, during the course of the past several years, almost 6 or 7 years by this point, in the course of representing these folks like George Papadopoulos and Carter Page and Mary Giuliani, Kyle Rittenhouse, et cetera. It just became patently clear to me in a way that I really had not understood before how dangerous this attack on our constitutional rights is by this kind of cabal of, you know, really, really Marxist, communist, fascist, tyrannical forces. I mean, it doesn't really matter so much the particular word used to describe them, but it's tyrannical. I mean, we're in a battle right now, not only in the United States, but across the globe, between tyranny and freedom. It's in many ways the oldest story in the history books, but now the stakes are so high because, you know, finally the world is essentially completely interconnected in so many ways. And there's really a fight right now between the forces that want to have the world in essentially a global operating system of authoritarianism and surveillance and social credit systems and things like that, and the forces that really want to see America return to the principles of 1776, and, you know, would like to see that be the way that everyone around the world can live. You know, in this fight, American lawyers really need to be and should be at the forefront and right in the middle of it, because I think that these kind of globalist forces like the World Economic Forum and the American Deep State and those kind of folks, the Chinese Communist Party, they understand very clearly that the American Constitution and the fighting spirit of regular Americans and the American Republic is really the final battle in this. And so, you know, it couldn't be more important. We do not have enough lawyers that are fighting this fight right now. And so, you know, I started the NCLU in order to, you know, start to try to gather, you know, these kind of lawyers together in an operating sort of, you know, network and affiliation, and really to try to raise as much money as we can for these fights. Because, you know, the folks like the January 6th defendants who are really the ones suffering the brunt of this right now, you know, these are folks that, you know, their lives have been destroyed. They do not have resources. And so, you know, we got to fight this fight. And it's, you know, I think we're actually doing pretty well now based on some various things that I could talk about that that we're seeing. But it is far from over. And we got to keep going.
Well, first things first, NCLU talking about, you have people that are in dire need of good representation. People can go onto the nclu.org webpage and you can join the cause. You can help represent these defendants. You can donate directly right there on the website. So I would encourage listeners, if as we're speaking with John tonight or while you're listening to this show, don't wait. Go put that into your phone. If this is a cause that you believe in, if you believe in helping support people's constitutional freedoms, their rights, then we want you to go ahead and make that donation to the NCLU because you've heard me talk about it countless times. We've had Michael Bednarik on before he died, and he said the most important thing was it was up to somebody else to carry the torch of liberty. If not, socialism had won, the Constitution was dead. I believe with people like John Pierce and the NCLU, we can hopefully fight back that tide and start taking control of the narrative that others would like to do in order to move us towards that Marxist regime where you can paint anybody your enemy. So, John, right now in January 6th, tell us about some of the cases that you've represented as well as what's coming up. Give people a little bit of insight.
Sure. So over the course of these cases, you know, myself and my team and folks who are affiliated with the NCLU have represented close to 50 January 6th defendants at various stages of proceedings, including bond revocation hearings and motion practice and trials, sentencing and appeals. So we have we've tried more cases than any other set of lawyers. I'm pretty confident. We've tried about 10 cases at this point, 10 or 11 cases. We have seven trials that are coming up in the next 3 months. And so, and thank you for mentioning that, we desperately need help. These folks do not have any substantial resources. And so, you know, folks can go and join or donate. You know, that contribution is going directly to the fight that's happening right now in Washington, D.C. If we do not have help from folks, the reality is we just can't continue to fight for these folks. Now, we'll find a way to do it, but we can't do it without help. So thank you for mentioning that. It is very, very, very important. But yeah, look, these cases are tough. There's no question. It's a tough venue. It's a tough jury pool. And we were up against an opponent that has unlimited resources. The Department of Justice has spent the FBI. They spent billions of dollars in the course of this investigation, these prosecutions, and they can call on as much more in the way of resources that they need to at any point in time. And so, so it's tough. We've gotten the best results so far of any set of lawyers. Now that's it's still the conviction rate is very, 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 very high. But it's really important to fight these trials as hard as possible because we need to establish the record at trial as fulsomely as possible so that we can have the best shot and appeal as possible.
So I heard a story a couple of weeks ago where some of these January 6th prisoners were transported somewhere. Is that a true story where we don't know where some of these people are?
So, you know, there have definitely been various accounts of various prisoners, whether it be pre-trial detention or it be folks that are serving a sentence already, that have been moved and transported in ways that seem to be highly questionable and potentially nefarious in terms of the moves themselves, the process of the moves being essentially a form of punishment. You have seen accounts where individuals report being, put on buses for hours and hours and hours on end without enough food, without enough water, in difficult sort of climate conditions on the bus, without the ability to really have proper facilities. It's hard to know exactly what's happening, right? Because there's not a lot of visibility on exactly what is happening, but there definitely have been accounts of that. There's also been some folks, we represented one individual, Lucas Denny, for a period of time, who was essentially lost in the system for about 80 or 90 days before he had, his arraignment. And it was just a blatant violation of his constitutional rights, as the judge found.
I was going to say that. How is this not a speedy trial? And this is 4 years at this point.
Yeah, no, that's right. What you have is in many of these cases, like, so for example, I mean, we have dozens of these cases, right? So our trial calendar is stacked up. We literally have two trials a month for the next 3 or 4 months, right? And so you have sort of competing interests here and multiple things going on. In the first instance, at the beginning, it took a long time for the Department of Justice to provide proper discovery for defendants.
For people that don't know what discovery is, what is discovery?
Yeah, so discovery is essentially the evidence that relates to the case. So gotcha. It's essentially okay. Documents and sure. Videos and witness statements and things like that that relate to the case. You had really a couple of years where it took the Department of Justice to get organized sufficiently to put these terabytes and terabytes of data. I mean, we're talking about, hundreds and hundreds of millions of pages of documents and, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of hours of video onto a platform so that the defense counsel and defendants could actually review them in a meaningful way. You had that going on. I mean, now you have these trials that are really happening very, 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 very quickly. And so there's sort of a competing interest for defendants. On the one hand, many of them do want their kind of speedy trial. On the other hand, you need to be prepared for these trials in order to make sure you can put forth a good defense and have a shot at winning on some of these counts and have a good record for appeal. It's almost like
it's going on both ends. Right. So one side needs to be prepared. So that's why this is taking so long. And the other side could be slow walking all of this to create an image that if you do something like this, then we're going to make this example out of you.
Yeah. And one of the biggest issues, of course, and you kind of mentioned prisoners and being transported. One of the biggest issues, of course, is that you have had and still have so many individuals, so many defendants who have been detained pre-trial. And so, they do not have the opportunity to put forth any kind of bail to get out. It doesn't matter if they had, a house that was worth $1 billion. If the court finds that they're essentially either a threat to the community or a flight risk, they cannot get any bail. And so, you know, they're detained pre-trial. And, you know, that creates all kinds of issues, including it makes it extremely difficult for a defendant to prepare with his lawyer for the trial.
Right. And if there's a liberal judge, I mean, forget about it.
Look, I mean, there's no question that DC is a very, very tough venue in multiple ways. You know, you have a jury pool in DC that was in DC essentially on January 6th. You have a lot of jurors, many, many, many jurors who are either federal government employees or closely related to federal government employees. You know, and to some extent, for almost all of them, this was a personal experience. And so you have a very, very tough jury pool. We attempt to change venue. We file motions to change venue in every case, as essentially all the lawyers are doing. And every one of those motions has been denied so far. So, you know, we're going to keep fighting on that front as more data kind of emerges. And it does create an issue potentially for appeal. But DC is a very, very tough venue.
I know from talking to Jacob Angeli Chansley, he was on the show several months ago, also spoke with a couple other people who were fighting charges. Their wives have contacted me to tell their stories, and I've shared those stories on my show. It seems like the FBI wanted to paint a narrative and was trying to coerce statements out of the people that they've been accusing of certain actions while there. Have you come across where it seems like the Department of Justice and the FBI is colluding to create a different narrative than what the charges should be? Are you seeing charges that are raised beyond what's reasonable?
Well, I have been extremely, extremely vocal about the FBI in the past few years. And this even goes before January 6th. I mean, when I saw what was occurring with respect to the Russia hoax in representing George Papadopoulos and Carter Page, and I understood the depths of corruption within the federal intelligence community and law enforcement community, it became very apparent that we had a corrupt FBI. And I've been very direct about that. You know, there is no question, and this is public because there has been lots of evidence now that has come out in these trials that there were federal assets there at January 6th. And there are a lot of questionable things that happened on January 6th with respect to it not being an armed insurrection as the narrative has right. You know, attempted to portray. I think at the beginning, and I started representing folks immediately after January 6th, a day or two after. I think at the beginning, in the first 6 to 9 months, the left, the media was extremely successful in painting this narrative by using selective, you know, videos of sort of the most violent aspects of January 6th. And I think that people in the middle, even many people on the right, were really sort of buying into that narrative. I think that because we have fought so hard, tooth and nail, ferociously over the past more than 3 years now, I think essentially you've seen that narrative flip in the country in terms of, you know, the vast majority of the country understanding that whatever January 6th was, it was not an armed insurrection, and that there were agitators, there were leftist agitators, and there were federal assets that were there.
Have any of the people that you've represented, or is anybody been accused of insurrection? Is that any of the charges? Because I've never seen insurrection as a formal charge that somebody was tried with, but perhaps I missed one.
No, you're absolutely correct. And this is another thing I've been very vocal about from the beginning, is that there are no charges for insurrection against anyone. Insurrection is an actual crime under the federal code. There are no charges for insurrection against any January 6th defendant. There are no charges for insurrection against President Trump. And you can be very sure, and this became very clear to me from the beginning, that there was a very, very calculated a determination to use the word insurrection from the get-go. And that is what you've seen with respect to the attempt that's now failed, thanks to the Supreme Court, to kick Trump off the ballot under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And so, you know, this was not an armed insurrection. You know, essentially there were no, essentially no January 6th defendants, with some very, very, very small number of exceptions, had any weapons, firearms. You know, the concept of insurrection as sort of, you know, intended under the 14th Amendment really related directly to the Confederates in the course of the Civil War, and, you know, an actual organized, armed, sustained effort to, in fact, overthrow the government. January 6th can be described as many things. You know, it was a rally that turned into a protest that, in, you know, various ways for various reasons, not all the fault of the January 6th defendants, turned into a riot in certain places at certain times. But this was not an armed insurrection. That's, you know, and I now think that the American people understand that very clearly.
I think one side of them understands very clearly. I think that the people that follow MSNBC and CNN still are using the same words. And
yeah, yes. I mean, you're going to have those, you know, kind of media propaganda arms that are just going to hammer this over and over and over again, you know, throughout the election, because, and this is really one of the reasons that we fought so hard. And have been very successful in many ways. You know, we have successfully sort of collapsed so many of these attempted narratives over the past, you know, few to several years, from the Russia hoax to the Ukraine nonsense, the COVID nonsense, the big tech conspiracy to censor Americans has been exposed. I mean, obviously, every real issue that exists out there with respect to, you know, the border and the economy and things like that, is a disaster for Joe Biden and the Democrats. And so they really have nothing else to run on at this point, except to try to continue to gaslight the American people into thinking that this was some kind of, you know, armed insurrection.
Yeah, that is the craziest thing, because I call that whole January 6th episode the rabble rally, because I refuse to believe that that was a true insurrection. And Greg is right. We're on a text chain with a few lunatics that genuinely believe that that was an insurrection. And we have to say, does anybody remember the Jefferson Davis? I mean, you want to talk about an insurrection? Let's go back.
And you can be sure that, you know, with this Department of Justice, who very openly has described their approach to January 6th as essentially scorched earth, you can be very sure that if there was any basis to charge a crime of insurrection, they would have charged a crime of insurrection against someone.
Exactly.
And they, you know, they have not done that. I mean, what happened, and I'm always mindful to speak kind of generally about January 6th, because yeah, I am involved in you know, these cases as a lawyer, so I have to be mindful of not really talking about specific cases. But what happened on January 6th is tens of millions of Americans were very, very upset that the election had been stolen. And many of them, millions of them, came to Washington, D.C. to petition their government for redress of grievances. And you know, they went to hear President Trump speak. You know, many of them, as he indicated in his speech, suggesting that folks should go down and peacefully and patriotically protest, did make their way down to the Capitol. Many of them did not see any barricades. Many of them did not see, you know, any police officers telling them to leave. In fact, many saw the opposite. Many of them saw no signs indicating there was a restricted area. Right. You know, then various things started to unfold, and it did turn into a riot in different places in different ways. And, you know, one can argue in different cases about who was responsible for that in various places at various locations. But it's a very complicated event, and it is not a one-sided event, and it was not an armed insurrection.
No, and there's a lot going on there with that, and I do believe there are some rogue elements within the various agencies that really egged that on. But I want to change course a little bit.
Before you do, Chris, okay, I just want to ask John if he knows something about the actual insurrection that's brewing in this country right now. I just tagged him on X because I posted the story on March 1st that Carlin Borisenko put out. She infiltrated a socialism retreat, so to speak, and she posted some footage from October 7, 2023 from the Revolutionary Communists of America, who are literally talking about arming one another and overthrowing our government. And the media has been absolutely silent. This was held in America, trying to get people to follow communism and to arm people for it. Where's the charges towards the people that are actively looking to overthrow our government in 2024 in the next election.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that's a perfect example of what is a very, very real and very dangerous two-tiered system of justice that folks, you know, now are really, really seeing and are really talking about. And this weaponization of the justice system and the legal processes in this country as a political weapon. So what you always see time after time after time after time is that those on the left, you know, Marxists and communists and Antifa and BLM, you know, they can go and they can try to burn down a federal courthouse for 100 days on end. They can, you know, try to create a chop zone there in Seattle or a Chaz zone or whatever it was called, which is an actual literal insurrection taking over part of a city and declaring that it's some kind of independent state. And so, you know, this is so dangerous because, you know, really the fundamental American idea is that we're all equal before the law. That is the fundamental American idea. And when the faith in that concept has been shattered and simultaneously the faith in any kind of free and fair elections has been shattered, that is a very, very bad recipe for the social cohesion, the fabric of a free republic. And that cannot last for very long. And I think what you're going to see, and Raheem Kassam of National Pulse has talked about this recently. I would be very concerned about January 6th with respect to what happens when Trump wins in November. I think that you're going to have an effort on the left, especially if the Democrats somehow take control of Congress, to refuse to certify that election. And so, you know, that's the thing with these kind of once the Pandora's box, once the genie's bottle is open to use legal process and use the judicial system as a political weapon, that's what brought down the Roman Republic. It becomes a cycle that is very, very rapidly spiraling downhill and is very difficult to stop. And we're right in the middle of that kind of vortex right now, and it's got to come to an end.
I'm glad you brought that up, John. I was just talking to somebody who's a very great critical thinker. He lives out in LA, but I find that he is very balanced in the way he views things. And he said to me, he said one of his concerns about Donald Trump was the fact that Donald Trump laid out the roadmap in order to use Congress in order to usurp the election. And our point that we had in our conversation was, what's keeping the Democrats from following the same thing they're accusing Donald Trump of doing? And you stating that, you know, if Donald Trump gets duly elected, do you have to worry about a Democrat-controlled House doing the same thing that the lawyers mapped out for Donald Trump? I mean, do you find that what Donald Trump did was dangerous in that respect? His lawyers, not really Donald Trump, but the lawyers, and maybe showing everybody, exposing the weaponization that we could use against a Democratic vote?
I think that, you know, and I have to say I was so, so consumed with the Kyle Rittenhouse case as the election in 2020 took place and as it headed up to January 6th, that I really did not follow kind of the ins and outs of what was happening and those kind of actually the specific arguments that were being made, et cetera. But, you know, the basic thing I think that President Trump was advocating for, and he had an absolute right to do it under the First Amendment, was advocating for the process that was laid out in the Electoral Count Act to unfold with respect to objections that representatives and senators could make, and then that would be considered and heard in the course of that process. And you know, and I essentially that. You know, that is completely in bounds in terms of, you know, what can occur in that process. I do think that the left is going to attempt to do everything they can when Trump wins to use January 6th in a way that will make January 6th, 2021, honestly look like a walk in the park. You know, because that's the way that the left, you know, sort of does anything. If they actually intend to, you know, weaponize something in the law, they go all out. And so I am very, very concerned that that's going to be a major, major issue when President Trump wins. I am optimistic and I have confidence that this Supreme Court, if it needs to, will take the right steps and the appropriate litigation to deal with challenges when President Trump wins. But of course, we'll have to see how that plays out. It's going to be a very, very scary ride up until the inauguration, I believe, of 2025.
Do you think that there is a foreign influence with all of this lawfare?
Oh, I think there's no question about it whatsoever. I think that you know, really what you're seeing is a very, very highly sophisticated and something that has been in planning and execution for, you know, decades, really.
Right.
But for many, many years, where, again, there is a combination of, and I think the primary players are folks like the World Economic Forum, the Chinese Communist Party, the American deep state, sort of corporate boardrooms and you know, high level financiers around the world, big tech companies around the world, who essentially would love to see a final revolution to install communist rule across the entire world. And I think they're very smart and clever. And you know, folks like George Soros, right? Bad guy, but he's not dumb. And I think what they realized, and they realized some time ago, was that if that was going to succeed, the American Republic, the American Constitution had to be broken. And so, you know, I think you see on places like MSNBC and CNN at this point, folks are being very brazen about it. I mean, they're actually talking about a post-constitutional America, and they're actually outright saying that, you know, the Constitution is bad in so many ways, and we need to get rid of it. We need to, you know.
Or it's an old document. It needs to be updated.
Yeah, and what really needs to happen is we need an absolute and unconditional restoration of our Judeo-Christian founding and constitutional order. That's what really has to happen. And in conjunction with that, we really need a spiritual revival in this country, because as the founders indicated, you know, you could have the best written constitution ever devised by mankind, which we do. But if it is not undergirded by a virtuous moral people, as they say, it's hardly worth the paper it's written on.
Yeah.
And so, we have to stay focused like a laser beam on that. Not only until we get President Trump back in the White House, but for the next, you know, many years, certainly the next 5 to 10 years and even decades after that. But you know, if we let the Constitution slip away, you know, it will be a tragedy of monumental and epic and historical proportions, because we will be essentially handing away the greatest gift that God has ever given a people.
John, I've done some shows over the last few weeks that if I didn't question you on this and ask your opinion, my listeners would probably come at me and say, well, gee, you've had no problem saying this to General Flynn and saying this about the movement that he's with, as well as Turning Point USA. I've talked about the Judeo-Christian message, the reawakening tour, and I've been a critical of it for the fact that most of the founders were theistic rationalists. They weren't Christians. They did not intend to create a Christian nation. And this is kind of more my wheelhouse of things that I get into. I agree with you 100% that we need a moral society, because I've been talking to individuals about why is it that we're slipping to relativism? Why is it that it's relativism towards what you feel is right, because that's subjective versus objective. But I believe that the reawakening and the Judeo-Christian, I wonder if that does not actually kind of turn people away from returning to a constitutional republic and instead push people that might just need to understand the importance of having a moral set and what that related to within the Constitution, of understanding the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That's a fair point. It's a great question. I think it's a very, very important question that we all have to wrestle with and grapple with and talk about right now and over the coming years. Because one thing is for sure, we are going to emerge from this kind of crisis time in American history as something new, something that is going to be different, very different than what it is as we sit here in the middle of this struggle that we're in right now. I think when I say sort of Judeo-Christian sort of founding of the country, I do not mean that in the sense that that in any formal way. You know, the country was founded, sort of theocratically, or sort of pursuant to the sort of precise principles of a certain religion. But there's no question that the very idea of America that we are all equal before the law really comes from the notion that we are all made in the image of God. And to a large extent, I think it's pretty clear when you look at history that idea really does kind of spring from traditions of a Judeo-Christian tradition, from the Ten Commandments onto the idea that a covenant with God could be extended to, you know, to all folks, not just Jewish people. It's a very interesting kind of historical question. I think the most important thing is that, you know, Americans, I think one of the problems we're having right now in the West, generally speaking, is that we've kind of forgotten who we are and we've forgotten what identity we really have. And I think it's led to a certain timidity and almost civilizational suicidal tendencies that we don't, in order to really fight for something, you have to know like what it is you're fighting for, you know, and you have to believe very, very much in that. I believe America is the most exceptional nation in the history of the world. And one can, kind of talk about and discuss kind of where that emanates from and what, kind of where that comes from. But America has done more good for more people in its short life than, you know, any other country ever. And so I think that, you know, we have to get back to that and have to remember how special this country is.
Right. We need to have the custodians of society come back. And we need to start to realize that each one of us has a certain element of divinity that does make us special. And that is constant throughout mankind. But you said something that's important, and I want to kind of tie it into what we saw with this foreign influence. And that's the idea of cancel culture. Why on earth are we being subjected to this nonsense? And have you done any research about the TikTok bill that's been going around and the potential financial ties to all of this?
So I have seen the discussion about TikTok in the last few days, and it's actually a very interesting one, because on either side of it, you're seeing some elements of the right that are for it, and you're seeing some elements of the left that are for it, and vice versa, that are against it. So I think in the last day or so, President Trump actually came out pretty strongly against the ban, which I think was viewed as many people as being somewhat of a reversal of what seemed to be his position, previously. And you see some folks who are for the ban that are part of each side of the political spectrum that you would never expect to kind of be allied on any certain issue. One of the people that I represent is Laura Loomer, a former congressional candidate. And real vocal, conservative kind of MAGA activist and huge supporter of President Trump in her civil RICO case against big tech and elements of corporate America and the federal government for, how they deplatformed her and canceled her. You know, her and Alex Jones were really two of the very, very, very first people that were, quote unquote, canceled. And she was completely removed from social media in the course of both of her congressional campaigns in 2020 and 2022, both of which she nearly won and arguably did win, because I think there was a lot of cheating going on in those elections, as we saw. But I think that you see now what exactly happened. I mean, the FBI went and got with Facebook and Twitter. It was when they realized what was happening with the Hunter Biden laptop. They sat on it for about a year, and then they went to these companies, and they essentially cajoled these companies into not talking about it, into mm-hmm. taking down the stories from the New York Post, et cetera. And so I think it's a very calculated tactic of the left in this kind of, communist takeover that we're talking about to silence dissenting voices and to intimidate others into speaking up.
Well, Bill 686, the TikTok bill that is passing the House and it's going to go over to the Senate that we're talking about, to me, is the most egregious violation of civil liberties since the Patriot Act and the Patriot Act 2.0. In that bill, it enables any social media service that has over 1 million subscribers, it enables the government to be able to have access to all the files on your phone, that's your videos, that's any recordings that you happen to do. This is a complete overreach that has nothing to do with a foreign entity of China making TikTok and everything to do with basically the government saying, yeah, we've been legally monitoring you all this time, but now we're going to legalize it through this bill and backdoor it. And I'm paying attention to every damn congressman, every senator that's going to sell out our rights over the next few days because, yes, you have the Twitter files. You see Facebook colluding. You have President Biden, who was able to get, or the DNC, intelligence agents to sign off on Hunter Biden's laptop saying it was Russian collusion or misinformation. I interviewed John Paul MacIsaac. I sat down with John Paul. I live here in Delaware with him. He's actually the next door neighbor of one of my best friends. One of the nicest, kindest, most trustworthy people when I asked others about his character. Now you got Hunter Biden going in front of Congress saying, hey, you know what? No one's actually ever seen the laptop. Bullshit. I know for a fact the laptop exist and has Bo Biden's sticker right on the top of it. I don't think there's too many other people that are going to sign Hunter Biden's name around the corner from his house with that. How is it that the DNC, Joe Biden, Hunter Biden continue to deceive the American public, weaponize an FBI that seems to lean liberally on this side and get away with it repeatedly without anyone holding them accountable?
Yeah, look, I mean, that is a massive, massive problem in this country right now. And I think I hold responsible, honestly, the congressional, the House GOP. You know, the House Republicans, and like, I'm pure MAGA, I'm pure populist conservative, you know, Republican. I have no love lost for the establishment of the Republican Party, however. And, you know, they have an absolute plenary power to cut off funding to any part of the federal government. The Constitution was created with this very specifically in mind, that they knew at some point the government could and probably would become tyrannical. And the one way to make sure that you could stop that is to cut off the funding. And so as opposed to regular legislation, which you know, both houses of Congress, you know, they can propose, and if it's passed, the president can sign. Every single spending bill, as I'm sure you know, has to originate in the House of Representatives. And so, you know, whether it's the big tech collusion or whether it's, you know, things in connection with, you know, with January 6th or whatever it might be, the House GOP has not done a single thing to stop this from a funding standpoint. I mean, they could in a nanosecond, they could simply refuse to fund the January 6th prosecutions, for example. They could shut down the FBI by not giving it any funding. And so, you know, that's who I hold responsible, because they have the power to stop it. And they say that they want to stop it, but they don't. But yeah, I mean, look, ultimately the American people are going to have to make this stop, at the ballot box, by getting President Trump back in there. And I really believe that, you know, based on what he went through in the first term, and what they've done to try to destroy his life, his family, his business over the course of the past couple of years, that he is going to go in there and he is going to deal with the deep state. I really believe that.
I certainly hope so. I just want to make everybody unhappy. You know what I mean? Which brings us to election integrity. How do American people regain faith in their elections? I mean, what happened in 2020 is ridiculous. 81 million votes. I mean, who believes that? And then in 2022, you saw all kinds of nonsense go on. And even in the latest primary, you saw just bizarre voting patterns where they had 79% of the counties tallied. And then in some cases, it flipped to 76%. And, you know, all kinds of bizarre voting things going on. I mean, is this a sign of I guess, I don't know if sedition is the correct legal term, but maybe subversion? Is there a fifth column in here trying to hijack these elections? This deep state?
I think I think there's all kinds of actors that are at play, you know, attempting to influence these elections. I think ultimately, the people by and large are not going to have complete faith the way they need to in the election system until we return to one day paper ballots, you know, rock solid ID methods and that sort of thing. You know, it's obviously going to be some time until we get back to that. I do think that has to be the long term goal. But I think, you know, I think in the near term, look, I mean, I think you see Lara Trump, who's taken over the RNC there. I think she's been very direct that we have to play by street fighting rules the same way that they do right now. They got to go out and they got to, you know, harvest as many mail-in ballots as they can. You know, it's just got to be fought in the courtrooms, et cetera. I think in terms of the trust factor, I think right now it's very much of a smell test with respect to the American people. I think that, you know, one of the big issues in 2020 was that, you know, people could see with their own eyes this massive enthusiasm gap between President Trump, who's able to get 55,000 people to see him in Butler, Pennsylvania, which is historically, you know, deep blue labor Democrat area. And then Joe Biden can only get, you know, 10 people in circles in a car when he's in his home state of Delaware. And, you know, I think when people see that a place like Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin, Trump has a 14-15 point lead or something like that at 11 o'clock at night, and they see these graphs with the lines that, you know, go straight up and magically, you know, all those votes come in. It doesn't matter what anybody says or argues. The American people just are not going to trust that. And so I think in the short term, it's just going to be, they're going to have people are going to have a very good sense of what this election result should be. And it's not going to be good if it's stolen again.
I don't know if you're able to talk about it. I don't want to put you in any bad situations with law and stuff, but I believe you were working at one point in time with Lynn Wood and some other individuals who are tied up in their own legal issues. The government has come after people like Sidney Powell, come after Lynn Wood at one point in time as well. I'm just kind of curious, you know, people say, where's the evidence? I came after 2,000 mules pretty strong 2 weeks ago after they failed to give up any more evidence of what they claimed was to have the data for election interference. So I've seen the graphs. I know something doesn't feel right. Yep. But as the average American citizen, I think everybody just wants the smoking gun. They want to go, where exactly is it? In your words, if you're able to, why is it no one's been able to show a smoking gun to the American public?
You know, because I think that the nature of what occurred in 2020 was so was kind of so widespread in so many precincts with so many different kinds of things going on that it really, you know, it really wasn't quite as simple as anybody necessarily flipping a switch or anything like that. I think it was a constellation of an accumulation of many, 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 many instances of, you know, some kind of fraud, some kind of cheating that piled up. And I think that, it was very clear which particular counties or precincts in which particular swing states were going to end up being decisive. And so I think there was probably a focus, you know, on those areas. You know, I have to say with respect to, you know, the issues that folks like Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood, you know, came to have to deal with. You know, I was working with Lynn Wood in connection with the Kyle Rittenhouse case. And then, you know, everything that occurred is really relating to what happened in that November election and in the following couple months. And so by that point, I actually was not working with, you know, with Lynn at that point, and I didn't end up having anything to do. Look, very fortunately, from a standpoint of being a lawyer, I didn't have anything to do with the election litigation, which is, I do not envy the people that that were involved in that. I think I think many of them. And, you know, I don't know Sidney Powell, but I've always respected her. I know Lynn Wood, and I respect him as a lawyer. You know, I think they had good intentions. And it was a very, very tough situation to be in because it was such a compressed time frame. And, you know, it was so different than 2000 with the hanging chads, right? Because that was one discrete particular issue in in one county, that if you watch the movie on HBO Recount, I mean, that was just a wild, wild, two or three months there, up and down to the, state appellate courts, the Supreme Court. And when you have something that is essentially nationwide that you're trying to deal with in terms of this litigation in the course of weeks or a couple of months, it's virtually impossible. So that was a tough situation for lawyers for sure.
Yeah. So, with all of this, there seems to be a push for people to start to realize that they have to take things into their own hands in a legal fashion. How can an average Joe hold these people accountable outside of the ballot box? Because we have to assume that that function is compromised. I mean, is it going after the sheriffs and getting the sheriffs on our side because they're the highest legal body in the county? I mean, is it something along those lines? I mean, what do you think?
I this is the reason I founded the NCLU. One of the huge issues, the biggest problem right now from my standpoint, and it's probably hard to it's probably hard for folks who are not right in the middle of the legal industry in these kinds of cases, to really kind of see the extent of this. There are hardly any lawyers in the country who are willing to stand up for kind of the side of things that I've been standing up for in the past several years. And when I say hardly any, I mean hardly any. I mean, it's not as if there are, 1,000 whereby there should be 100,000. It's like there are, a handful who are really willing to engage in these tough fights. I mean, lawyers are, not without some justification. I mean, they're terrified of being kicked out of firms. They're terrified of not being able to ever work for a law firm again. They're terrified of, frivolous bar complaints and attacks from Project 65, George Soros's funded entity, to come after lawyers' licenses. And it's bad. For example, when I started representing Carter Page, he didn't have a lawyer. He was pro se. These January 6th defendants are just in a terrible spot in terms of trying to find, effective lawyers. So honestly, and obviously it's something I'm focused on right now. I mean, the most important things that people can do is go to the NCLU and to support, groups like ours that are attempting to create some kind of organized, resistance, I guess, for lack of a better word, against this kind of leftist lawfare. It's really tough right now for folks to really make much headway just as individuals kind of in the legal system. Things are so kind of one-sided right now, and without serious resources, it's tough. So I think right now the most important thing is the ballot box, because I think that is, if we can get constitutional conservatives into office up and down the ballot, that's going to have the best impact. But what you say about sheriffs is a very good point. I mean, sheriffs in many ways are the last line of defense against the enforcement of unconstitutional laws. And so, every sheriff in the country should be refusing to enforce all manner of unconstitutional laws that have been passed.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. And I think a lot of sheriff departments are fearing this because they get federal funding. And also they're compromised by the same groups that want to see a change in this country.
Yeah, there is you're absolutely right in terms of fear. There is so much fear. And again, it is not unjustified. We are in a fight. I mean, we're in a battle. I mean, we're in a war for the future of this country. It's not pretty. It is ugly. There are going to be casualties. But we only have one option, which is to fight and win. Whether it's individuals just being willing to speak their voice at a town hall meeting or on social media, or whether it's sheriffs being willing to not enforce unconstitutional laws, or it's lawyers willing to stand up for unpopular causes, on and on and on. We've got to put our head down and we got to fight. We got to win.
I can't help but notice the parallel that the law community is going through, that the doctor and medical community has gone through over the last 4 years as well. It's almost as if some of the most trusted people that were out to look after you and I have been targeted in order to silence their voices, in order to have tyranny ring true. On our network, we have Dr. Peter McCullough. Dr. McCullough went on to the Joe Rogan show, and immediately people called for the cancellation of Joe Rogan. They went after Peter's medical license. They didn't want him to have his residency anymore, despite the fact that he was and still remains the most published and peer-reviewed doctor almost in the history of medicine. But they've made it now where doctors don't want to speak up. They're making it now where lawyers don't want to represent the people. That is a dangerous thing for both your health and your security. And I'm not too sure I know how to fight back. You know, the Trusted News Initiative, John, you were talking earlier about the working together of the big tech companies. The Trusted News Initiative was the BBC, Google, and a bunch of other companies, Washington Post, I think New York Times might have been there as well. I got to go back through my list. But that Trusted News Initiative was colluding on the narrative of what you were allowed to say for medical information. As a result, I just had a show pulled from YouTube and I got a strike a week or 2 weeks ago for quoting the WHO, the World Health Organization. I was quoting their statistics, but they didn't like the fact that it wasn't favorable for mRNA. So, yeah, I'm just, this fight that you're taking on, NCLU, can you kind of summarize here to wrap up? Why is this the most important thing with what I just said for people to be involved in?
Yeah, look, because everybody's constitutional rights are at stake. This is not going to stop. This is not going to stop with President Trump. I mean, the attacks are not going to stop at January 6th defendants. Ultimately, if constitutional rights are shredded the way that they've started to become shredded, every American is ultimately going to suffer. I mean, going back to what you were just saying, absolutely. I mean, the left is very, very targeted in their methods. And with respect to COVID, they were coming after the doctors who would speak up, right? With respect to lawfare. Look, when I decided to represent Kyle Rittenhouse, I knew it was going to be absolute hell. I did not know how bad it was going to get. But I knew it was the most important self-defense case in the history of the Anglo-American legal system. I knew nobody, not a single human being, was doing anything to help the kid, lawyer or otherwise, and that fight had to be fought. Because if that turned out to be, if Kyle Rittenhouse ended up being convicted of murder for that incident in which there were so many high-definition videotapes making it so clear that it was absolutely perfect self-defense, the right of self-defense would have been eviscerated. So, you know, right away started getting, you know, thousands of death threats. The media attacks that I received were just, you know, you can see that very quickly just by Googling it. And it was absolutely brutal. Right. And so, you know, people see what happens to folks like me in that situation and they don't, you know, they don't have the courage to stand up for these things. The other point is with respect to January 6th, you know, historically, you know, I've been a partner at a couple of the most elite big law firms that they're out there. And they're always talking very much about their pro bono activities and how important that is, how important it is to represent the downtrodden. And they were perfectly happy, many of them, to go down to Gitmo and represent, terrorists who had attacked America, right? I mean, they were proud of that. But so far as I know, there is not a single hour of pro bono work that a single one of the AmLaw 200 firms, the largest 200 law firms in the country, with, you know, tens and tens of thousands of lawyers, hundreds of thousands of lawyers, have put in to help a January 6th defendant, right? And so, you know, what we're trying to do with the NCLU is essentially what the ACLU used to say it did, which was to fight for the downtrodden and fight for constitutional rights. And, you know, that's in the early days, they fought for Nazis in the KKK, right? Because they were the least popular folks, but their constitutional rights of free speech were at stake, right? Now you just have hardly anyone who's willing to stand up for unpopular people whose constitutional rights are being violated. And it has to be done. If we do not fight in the trenches for constitutional rights with defendants who are facing these cases, I mean, we're toast. That is the one way to preserve the Constitution over the long run.
Well, folks, you can go to National Constitutional Law Union, which is nclu.org. You can check out that website. We started the show off telling everybody about what we were talking about tonight. You can donate right there. You can donate to the cases that matter, the people's constitutional rights. I think John and us, we made the case tonight for you to understand the importance of why this legal battle is such an important one for all of us. Not just the people that are fighting the legal battles, but it's an American issue. You can also find John as well. He has John Pierce Law. So you go to johnpiercelaw.com. You can find his page there, and all of his socials and ways to contact and reach out are right there. So if you find yourself, maybe I know I have listeners that are part of the January 6th defense, and you're just hearing John's voice for the first time, reach out. Let him know who you are and what you need, and we'll get you in touch directly. John, I appreciate you taking time, giving an hour of your time tonight to come on to the show.
Thank you so much, guys. Look forward to doing it again.
All right, Bold Americans, we hope that we honored your time well. Make sure you check out the NCLU as well as John M. Pierce, his website. We'll be back next week with a whole brand new week of episodes on the America Out Loud News Network. Can't wait for you to join me there. Be bold, America.